Paul was my half-brother, but I never called him that. This was partially out of loyalty, for I remained devoted to him despite everything.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer and teacher Ed Tarkington. His first novel, Only Love Can Break Your Heart, published by Algonquin Press, happens in moments.
Sometimes the most thoughtless, accidental, seemingly irrelevant choices seem to ripple on endlessly. Sometimes the weight of the choice is obvious.
Only Love Can Break Your Heart, and its author, Ed Tarkington, on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with Virginia writer Ed Tarkington. You ain't no one in this town. To someone, won't you dead? First, they lift you up so high, then they come for your head. His first novel, Only Love Can Break Your Heart, explores the city limits of fictional Spencerville. Its grassy fields and horse farms, Georgian-style homes and stately colonial manses, and its inhabitants filled up with guilty ghosts from the past.
In a town built on tobacco money, people were willing to plead ignorance as long as the world would let them. I do not mean to say that the town was free of any sort of calamity or that we all lived oblivious to the news of the world, but we could still leave our doors open at night. We were isolated, insulated, largely ignored, and perfectly content.
Ed Tarkington, prep school teacher, novelist, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Brad. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my story of a strange and also typical family in the hills of Virginia in the late 1970s and early 80s.
So this is the Askew family. They're a little askew, really.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is a novel, as you said, about a dysfunctional family or a family that's in pieces.
Yes, but what I've come to discover in the time since I wrote it and published it and have met a lot of people and talked to them about it is that this family is far more typical than I really expected.
Well, I loved you then, and I love you now, and I'll never tell a lie, and I'll look you right square in the face, and I'll look you right in the eye.
Origin story of the book was pretty poignant.
I've been very frank about that. My family is not like this family, but is similar in certain relevant ways. The main family in the story, the Askews, the patriarch, the father, who is mostly referred to as the old man by his sons, is on his second marriage as the story unfolds, just as my father was. Paul is the older half-brother of the narrator, Rocky. I have a half-sister, an older half-sister. When I first got the idea to write the book, it came out of a kind of bedrock experience in the past when I discovered that my sister, who I loved and who I thought was incredibly cool and rebellious, and when I was about 10 years old, I discovered in the worst way imaginable that she was really struggling with mental illness. She attempted to take her own life, and seeing the effect that that had on my father was a very shocking and galvanizing experience for me. Kind of awakened my nascent creative imagination. I felt a compulsion to try to work out the emotions I began to experience then on the page. But I didn't want to write her story or try to write a memoir. I felt like that was too personal. And also, I couldn't create the kind of emotional honesty that I wanted to create by telling a true story. I had to tell a fictional story. I had to create a character that was not her, not my sister, but someone who experienced some of the same hardship and also some of the same emotional trauma and anger and frustration with her particular predicament as a child of the first marriage, watching these younger children growing up being a bit more doted upon and probably feeling a bit left behind at times.
And your wings go out over cropped the skies. I saw you there in the wind and the sky. I shook my head at your cropped dust eyes, and I'll never tell a lie.
And so I went in that direction, and I created a brother instead of a sister, Paul, and put him into similar situations, but with very different outcomes and very different trajectories, and tried to ramp the stakes up so that the tension would be more palpable to the audience based on a fictional, more exaggerated account of the kind of things we were experiencing when I was younger. The ways in which the world outside Spencerville was evolving showed up in the form of small, short-lived trends like disco or laser light shows or key parties. We were coming of age in the late 70s at the sweaty, nauseous, split-headed peak of a hangover between Watergate and Morning in America.
It has become evident to me that I know...
Who said he was getting elected to end the war? Turns out to be very...
Tear gas first started down the commons, and the guard moved up on...
We flew to the streets of Saigon.
You take a very an intelligent person with the normal hopes and ambitions and confine her to the home.
We've known now for over 10 years that the strike breakers and the growers are armed.
Disco sucks! Disco sucks!
It's morning again in America. Today, more men.
This book's also informed a lot by music.
Absolutely.
The title?
Yes. When I was a boy, and I think when a lot of people of our generation were growing up, music was much more of a source of identity than it is for people growing up today, because it wasn't so disposable or random. We didn't have access, as young people do today, to everything through the internet. So you had to be kind of a curator.
You thought it would be a safe thing here. Your heart is now broken and I've disappeared.
And you had to cultivate a taste, and you found a figure, an icon that you identified with or wanted to identify with, and that person became sort of a hero or a role model or a source of consolation. And so I imagined that person for my character Paul being Neil Young. With the title, it was just sort of serendipity. I was driving around listening to After the Gold Rush in my truck and kind of thinking, what the heck am I going to call this book? I just couldn't think of a good title for it. I had a few ideas, but I wasn't sure. And then I was listening to the title song, After the Gold Rush, which I really love, and thinking, well, maybe I can nick a lyric from this song or something. But then I started thinking about it, and I was like, ah, that doesn't work. This song's about like outer space and stuff like that. It's a end of the world song.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceships flying in the yellow haze of the sun.
And the next song that came on was Only Love Can Break Your Heart. And it just hit me like a light bulb went off over my head, and I thought, that's it. That's perfect.
When you were young and on your own, how did it feel to be alone? I was on...
Twin Oaks had been vacant for many years. The house stood in a clearing on the horizon under two southern red oak trees for which it was named.
But only love can break your heart. Try to be sure right from the start.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll be back with author Ed Tarkington in a moment. You're listening to Only Love Can Break Your Heart on Arts and Letters with author Ed Tarkington. The novel begins with a ghost story.
That was something that I really invented. It just kind of came to me. I wanted there to be a tone of the supernatural in the story because in the South, particularly in the mountain South, ghost stories are a big part of local culture. I was reading Great Expectations because I teach it around the time that I was plotting the book, and I was struck by the way that Dickens uses a lot of these archetypes. The house, the big, creepy, dark mansion. There's not a ghost per se, but there are a couple of spectral things that happen, and the character of Miss Havisham is certainly a kind of cross between a ghoulish, ghostly person and a damsel in distress who's been very wounded by the world and is kind of held hostage by her own disappointments and heartbreak.
If I were a tobacco farmer, I would smoke while I tilled and drink, bartered beer while I harvest. You ain't missing anything. I reserve missing just for me. Everybody.
And so I thought, well, I would love to have something like that. There are all these old houses. So as I started to think about what would be an interesting starting point, I wanted to use an old house as a way to bring some mystery and gothic mood, because there is some dark stuff on the horizon for these people once we move further into the story.
And particularly also, with relation to this house.
Absolutely. And afterwards, I realized that it also gave me an opportunity to go down a tunnel into the history of this little town that I'm describing.
Baby, you ain't missing anything. I reserve missing just for me.
And create an arc that shows how these kinds of stories happen over and over and over again. The scandal, the death, the disappointment. In a theatrical voice, my older half-brother Paul explained,
Twin Oaks had once been the country home of Frank Spencer Cherry, a descendant founder of Spencerville and heir to the large fortune his ancestors accumulated in the tobacco trade.
If I were a tobacco farmer, I would smoke while I tilled and drink, bartered beer while I harvest.
And I conceived this character of Frank Cherry, which is actually my father's younger brother's name, Frank Cherry Tarkington, and he died in the 70s. He had a sudden heart attack when he was really young. But he is this tobacco scion who loses everything in the 29 crash and commits suicide in this house, which then puts a pall of doom and tragedy and ominous shadow over this house, which looms on the hill above the home of my characters. I didn't know how Paul presumed to know all these details. He must have heard it from the old man, a compulsive storyteller, prone to embellishment. But Paul told the story with authority.
In 1929, the stock market crashed, and Frank Cherry lost everything. The party was over. The next day, he rode out here by himself. A few days after, when his horse showed up on Main Street with no rider, police came out and found him in his rocking chair with a pistol hanging from his cold, dead fingers.
What do you want me? What do you need me? Well, I don't need you, and you don't need me.
I've been in that house, you know. Want to check it out, Rocky?
So Paul convinces Richard, his kid brother, nicknamed Rocky, to check out the abandoned house.
Yes, and I think this is really the point where it becomes especially clear that Rocky's idolatry of Paul is so great that he will subject himself to fear and risk in order to stay with him. This bond is really the axis of the story, the boy who worships his older brother and who will follow him anywhere. My brother Paul had a reputation around town as a bad kid. This wasn't entirely undeserved, although what passed for bad in provincial little southern towns like Spenceville probably wouldn't arouse much notice in more cultured, cosmopolitan locales. But I wanted to really develop the strength of that bond as being so crucial, because Paul is going to betray Rocky in a really vicious and indefensible, almost unforgivable way.
By that time I knew what you were in for, but what can I do?
So the process for him of coming to terms with that happening to him and then finding a way to forgive and to still love his brother in spite of the bad things that he does, the hurt that he causes, the danger that he puts his younger brother in, is something that is important to me.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. We're speaking with author Ed Tarkington about his novel, Only Love Can Break Your Heart.
We slipped down the stairs and out the door into the damp cold.
Wait here.
He walked around the right side of the house. Climbing onto the cellar door, he hefted himself up and through the same window he must have used before. As the minutes stretched on, a powerful sense of dread overcame me. I wanted nothing more than to be home, secure in the fishbowl of Paul's room, or better yet, before the roaring hearth of the royal chamber, watching the Muppet Show while my mother read her Bible and the old man sat at his table in the corner, poring over his legal pads and contracts. I was about to turn and run home when the shape of a man emerged behind the house in the side opposite where Paul had climbed in. Though it was very dark, I could see that the man was dressed in a long, dark coat and black leather boots. He looked old, with gray hair cut close to his skull. He rounded the corner and stepped onto the porch. I realized that, whoever or whatever he was, I wasn't imagining him. He was there, before my eyes, heading toward the front door. I watched in mute horror as the man simultaneously reached for the doorknob and drew a pistol from the pocket of his coat. Before I could gather my wits to move or speak, a booming crack and a flash of light exploded from within the house, rattling the loose panes of glass in the frames of the windows. Over the roaring and ringing in my ears, I heard my brother moaning through the black rectangle of the open front door. At last, my voice returned to me. I didn't wait to see if Frank Cherry had heard me. I just ran. I ran so fast the field seemed to fly beneath me. My mother looked up with a start from where she sat in her armchair. The old man rose from his seat at the corner table. "Frank Cherry shot Paul," I said.
What a marvelous scene. It sets the stage for your novel. Secrets, ghosts, old money gone bad, violence, malicious intent. Why did you begin this with a ghost story?
Well, in a lot of ways, this is a novel about haunting. The way that the past haunts us. The way that we have to work hard to get free of it. In the minds of children, wherever they live, there are these places that capture their imaginations and terrify them. I wanted to put something into play in a place like that where the stakes would really get high. I really believe in the rule of Chekhov's gun, that if a gun shows up in a story, somebody ought to shoot it. And so I wanted to literally start off with a bang.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We'll be back with author Ed Tarkington in a moment. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to the sleepy town of Spenceville with its ghosts and gossip and secrets as we continue to talk with writer Ed Tarkington about his novel, Only Love Can Break Your Heart.
Paul didn't die. When I came home from school the next day, he was there in his room, his leg heavily bandaged and propped up on pillows. Lee Bowman, Paul's girlfriend, sat on the bed beside him.
Here's Rocky.
I was too young to know that Lee Bowman was already being thought of as a minor tragedy. Her mother had died of breast cancer when Lee was 11. Her father, the Honorable Prentiss Powell Bowman III, knew no other way to raise Lee than to push her to the absolute limits in everything.
And it's the same sad story you know too well. It's the same sad story.
So tell us about Lee Bowman, the girlfriend, because in so many ways, she's a tragic figure.
Yeah. I think that what tends to happen a lot, I've seen it happen, is that men or boys who have this restlessness, this compulsion to act out or to be mavericks, the sacrifices are not only made by the boys, the people who love them tend to make a lot of sacrifices too. And it's always been the case for so long. I mean, this is something that it's wonderful to see change in our culture, that girls, especially as a father of girls, I really like seeing this, that girls are, I think, getting a little bit better at not feeling as if everything in their life revolves around taking care of a boy or finding that bad boy and trying to fix him, but rather seeking their own achievements and following their own path. But Lee's one of those girls who sort of falls off of her own path toward what appears to be a happy life and decides she's gonna try and rescue this guy.
She said, babe, just let go.
She's got her own reasons in the story. She's lost her mother to cancer and is growing up with a not particularly sympathetic father. And so she has a little bit more attraction to someone who's wounded in the way that Paul is.
Sing out loud, sing with me.
And then other things befall her as well. She turns out, unbeknownst to Rocky and a lot of other people, have been dealing with her own demons of emotional trauma that eventually kind of escalates into mental illness. I just thought, what a fascinating character and how sad. And I just kind of fell in love with her as she came together in my imagination, and I wanted to save her and for her to be saved.
I fell in love with her too. It was,
oh,
it was
cool.
Because you know, in a sense, you want to save Paul.
Right.
But really, you want to save Lee.
She certainly deserves it more than he does.
Yes, a lot.
To her father's dismay, in the summer before her junior year, Lee began to be seen riding around in the passenger seat of Paul Askew's big purple car.
Take my eyes, help me see what this woman she's been doing to me.
Before long, she'd given up almost everything for Paul. Her father forbade Lee to see Paul, which prompted Lee to discover quite spontaneously that her father couldn't forbid her to do anything.
Hey, my day. Oh, they used to be free. Ain't no doubt. She gotta hold on.
Maybe Lee was looking for someone to help her down off the ceaseless treadmill he'd set her on. Or maybe Lee and Paul were star-crossed lovers from the beginning.
You write that he was her first love, and she was doomed to love him.
Come what may.
Come what may.
She got a hold on me. Woman got a hold on me.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. Let's listen as author Ed Tarkington continues to discuss his novel about bullying and betrayal. Only love can break your heart.
We must all recall the incomprehensible spite of the schoolyard bully, the random selectivity of his malice, the helpless acquiescence of his prey.
Go find what you love and let it kill you, boy. Don't do nothing without any feeling.
So you currently teach English in a prep school?
That's correct.
And that's just a great line.
Thank you.
The helpless acquiescence, because we've all been there.
Sure.
Don't you forget this world on earth.
Perhaps worst of all, the pathetic betrayal of the victim's so-called friends, who stand aside and perhaps even laugh and jeer, loyalty being a far less powerful instinct than self-preservation.
Dust and bone, they're the same. We all go back from where we came.
Later on in the story, the betrayals become more in that vein, where bad choices or cruel choices or decisions are made in self-interest. You know, I tell my students all the time when we talk about characters who make bad choices in novels that we read or in short stories, I ask them, when you did something that got you in trouble when you were a kid, what's the question that your parents always ask you first? What were you thinking? What's the answer to that question?
I wasn't.
I don't know.
The other lonely, heal the pain. And you'll find home someday.
And so most of the time, the bad choices that we make are impulsive, not calculated. Very few people get up in the morning and look in the mirror and say, I'm going to go do evil today. I'm going to go be bad. It just happens. And then they've got to figure out what comes next. And so that's where Rocky finds himself in multiple contexts, where he has to, as an older reflective narrator, peel the layers of the onion off of the decisions that were made by the people around him.
Don't forget to hold your mama tight, for soon this world she'll be leaving. Oh.
Rocky's first little inclination of becoming bad happens in the house. And then this is the second one with the bully. So Let's listen to that scene, which is very funny, too.
Thanks. Surely Paul never had to worry about being bullied, or as it seemed when I told him about Jimmy Hutter. Should I run? I asked. Out on the rug in front of the windows, Paul taught me how to throw a punch.
Don't swing. Get your dukes up and fire from the right beside your head like this. Plant your feet and get your legs into it. Same with your kick. Lean forward so you don't fall down.
Paul demonstrated a few quick jab cross combinations followed by short, fast knee kicks.
Here, hit me.
I aimed at his palm and punched it as hard as I could.
Come on, Rocky. The Italian Stallion can't hit like a girl.
He took out Led Zeppelin's first album and dropped the needle on Good Times, Bad Times.
Try again and yell when you do it. Yell. Yell. Rah!
Arr! A few weeks later, the inevitable moment arrived. As I sat at the lunch table among the other nerds, runts, and oddballs, I felt Jimmy Hutter looming behind me.
You know what I heard?
No.
I heard your father was a...
Is not.
You call me a liar?
I looked around, trying to spot Mrs. Goode, the lunch lady, who monitored the twittering crowd through the Coke bottle lenses of her glasses.
I think we need to settle this in the bathroom.
No. Let's do it right here. The chair screeched on the floor as I backed away from the table. The din of voices rose among us, but the aging Mrs. Goode, usually so reliably vigilant, made no sound. I took a deep breath, clenched my fists, reared back, and swung my foot toward Jimmy Hutter. The kick sent the chair crashing into the table. With my foot twisted in the legs of the chair between us, I tumbled toward Jimmy, who fell to the floor with me, where we lamely slapped and pawed at each other while a cheering throng formed around us. I felt a pair of powerful hands grasp my arms and lift me up from the floor. Byron, the janitor, had stepped through the crowd to snatch the two of us up and scuttle us off to the main office.
So we've all seen the scene.
Sure.
I'm wondering why you set it up with a bully.
Well, what I was really interested in, and one of my major narrative objectives, was to reflect on the difference between what we know when we're young about what's going on around us and what we discover years later on. And so there are seeds planted in that scene. Jimmy Hutter, the bully, says things to Rocky that have to do with things that Rocky does not yet know about his parents.
About his father.
About his father. And the motivation for that particular harassment comes out of something that's going to weigh heavily in what happens later in the scene. I also like the idea as a storyteller and as a reader of having climaxes build upon climaxes, maybe a little bit of bait and switch, maybe, you know, you think this is the big thing that's going to happen and then something else happens that's even more dramatic. I'm not going to be shy about the fact that I like to go for it in storytelling. I like stories where things happen. I don't think that every good story has to be about interior reflection. I think that action is a good thing in storytelling. And so I wanted to play around with that. And also, I felt like the story that I am telling in this novel is an emotionally draining story. And so I wanted to give whoever might want to read that story some levity here and there. As I sat there waiting to get hided by Principal Powell, I searched my mind frantically to deduce how quickly and easily I had transformed into a bad kid. I wondered how being bad worked. Was it something that happened accidentally? Did all people start out good?
In what ways is this novel about morality?
You know, I used to be really interested in Nathaniel Hawthorne, for instance, who has this really kind of didactic notion of good and evil. Right. And that had a big influence on me, particularly when I was in college. And so part of the journey that this kid is on is figuring out that no one is all good or all bad, that good people make bad decisions, that bad people are not 100% bad. No one is born terrible. And you have to find a way not necessarily to forgive people for doing terrible things, but to have empathy for them and understand that no one is acting purely out of malice. And I think my character's greatest desire, which I hope comes through by the end of the story, is to be a good person. And he's not sure how to do that. While I was sitting in the office in front of the school secretary, Ms. Hallenbeck, a shape appeared in front of my downcast eyes.
Hey there, Rocky.
It was Paul, dressed in tan slacks, a navy blazer, and a white shirt and tie.
So what has young Richard gotten himself into?
Fighting in the lunchroom.
Kids these days, right, Miss Hallenbeck?
Mrs. Askew didn't mention she'd be sending you, Paul.
Something came up at the last minute. I'm in town for an alumni thing, so I offered to help out.
Mr. Powell will want to speak with Mrs. Askew, or your father.
One of them will come tomorrow. They'll call to set up an appointment later on, I'm sure.
Well, all right. I'll tell him you're here.
If you don't mind, I'll take the little pugilist here down to the bathroom to clean himself up.
Make it fast.
As we reached the end of the hallway, I turned toward the restroom.
Not that way, brother.
Some years later, my mother told me a story about how Paul had come to take me out of school and in one of those odd chance instances had found me in the principal's office. He might have known what he was going to do all along, or he might have just taken the opportunity as it presented itself.
Life happens in moments, says Mom, sometimes. And this is my favorite sentence, I think, in the book. Sometimes the weight of our choice is obvious.
Again, I think when I wrote that sentence and when I began to think about what the novel would entail, I thought of that passage in Great Expectations where Dickens has Pip stop and address the audience and say, pause, you who read this, and think of the long chain of iron or gold, of thorns or roses that brought you to where you are today. I'm paraphrasing there. And so he's asking us as readers to consider those days, right? He says the formation of the first link of that chain that would never have been wrought but for that one single day.
You know, it's so funny because I hadn't thought of that, but this book is very influenced by Great Expectations.
Definitely. It's a Bildungsroman in as much as it is many other things. And I was very conscious of that effect, that question. Think, pause, you who read this, about that day, that moment that changed your life. And I actually give an assignment to my students where I asked them to write about that, to try to think of a day that changed them.
This is Arts and Letters. We'll return to our conversation with author Ed Tarkington in a moment. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to the fictional town of Spencerville, where betrayals and disloyalty will break your heart.
Everyone can tell, and I know damn well, but I ain't going there right now.
So after they did school, Paul and Rocky drive to Charlotte to visit Lee Bowman.
I ain't playing no game. So let's not.
Students were spread out across the steps, reading, talking, and smoking. When I spotted Lee among them, I ran to her.
Rocky?
Paul came up behind me, his shadow falling across Lee and the boy who sat next to her.
Hi.
Hey.
What a surprise.
I thought you might like it. Who's your friend?
Barton is my study buddy for econ. We have a test.
I got into a fight at school.
We need to talk. Stay here, Rocky.
Because we'll only let each other right now. We'll only let each other, you know. We'll only let each other
Finally, they returned. Lee's cheeks were streaked with tears. She knelt and opened her arms to hug me. I felt the dampness of her cheek against my own as I breathed in that peculiarly enthralling odor of cigarette smoke and strawberry shampoo.
Think about it.
Please, Paul, not now.
You promised.
You promised, too.
I sensed that Paul was suffering a rare defeat. Lee's eyes followed us as we walked away to see whether Paul would turn and look back. He didn't, but I did. Lee waved again and blew a kiss. I turned on my heels to run after Paul.
Oh, everyone can tell. And I know damn well. And yes, I know. So let's not.
And then they take a little drive.
Oh, it's a very specific place in my imagination. It's in the story, it's called John's Gap. The real place is called Pettit's Gap. It's on the Blue Ridge Mountains. Now, it's not geographically situated in the same place that it would be in the novel. It's probably about 50 miles away from there. But that particular feature of the little cliff that you can kind of walk up, this sort of sandstone slope, is a real place. And we used to go there when I was a kid.
Things that should last.
bottom of the valley, the road became flat and straight. The pace slowed. The rock-strewn path gave way to sand and dirt. Paul braked hard. The car slid for a moment and then stopped and was swallowed by the billowing dust.
Come on.
Every 20 feet or so, I stopped, panting and heaving, waiting for the burning in my legs to subside. Before long, Paul was just a speck above me, sitting just below the tree line above a rocky hump jutting out of the face, surveying the valley like a jaded emperor. By the time I reached him, Paul had already finished one cigarette and was preparing to light another.
They call this place John's Gap, because a kid named John got lost here back in the 1700s. One day, he was out with his dad, sitting on a stump while his old man cut timber. He stopped for a minute, turned around to say something to John, but when he looked at the stump where the boy had been sitting, John was gone.
Was that a story you heard as a kid? Or was this wholly made up?
Yeah, there's actually a place called John's Hollow, and it's kind of in the same vicinity, probably about 20 miles outside of Lynchburg in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And my scoutmaster told us that story when we camped there. I don't know if it's really part of any of the lore, but it certainly scared the fool out of us when we were little. When I tried to stand up, I felt myself falling forward. I saw myself bouncing down the mountainside, piled up in the rubble, my mangled corpse covered with a layer of soot, as if it had been rolled around in the ashes of 1,000 camel lights. I fell sideways and hugged the slope. The rock was cool against my face. When I looked up, Paul was gone.
So this is one moment of betrayal.
Absolutely.
His brother leaves him on the mountain. He's a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And thought about just leaving him there.
Well, that story also originates in kind of a childhood experience, which I have written about, where my half-sister took my older sister on a joyride without permission for several hours. My mother had left her at the house, my older sister, with my half-sister watching her while she went to pick me up from school. My older sister, 1 year older, was home from second grade with the flu. She was running about 102 degree fever. And when my mother got home after about a 15-minute trip to pick me up and go to the drugstore, they were both gone and didn't come back for several hours. My sister didn't learn until she was much older what had happened to her. She came home and just thought she'd been on a joyride. But what was going on there was a sort of assertion of power. My half-sister was angry at my mother. She was showing her, I can hurt you in the worst way imaginable. Don't mess with me. When I heard that story, it just chilled me. And so I wanted to duplicate the emotions that I felt.
So in this case, just a little background, Paul's mother has died.
Yes.
She wasn't the most likable character in the world,
no.
But still he's pretty broken up by it. And then he goes to Lee and obviously is asking her to leave with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes it out on the one person who loves him the most.
That's right.
Wow.
That happens, doesn't it? Sometimes they're the easiest targets.
I'm pretty sure that you're the devil. I ain't so sure that I really mind.
Okay. So Paul does come back to get him.
He does.
He changes his mind.
I think that he's basically a good guy, and he loves his brother, and so he does, I think, ultimately kind of come to his senses, but he also feels that at that point he's crossed a line that he can't come back from.
Now on any other day, I would turn and walk away.
Paul helped me into the back seat of the car. With my face buried in the crook of my elbow, I listened to the purr of the engine and the pebbles flicking up from beneath the tires until we reached the top of the hill, where Paul hooked a smooth, deliberate left back onto the paved road.
How did you do it? Steal my heart away. That's a neat trick.
others have tried.
As we drove on, I thought of poor little John wandering around in the hollow, wailing at the night. After what seemed like a long while, the car came to a stop. I sat up and looked out the window. Paul had parked in front of Twin Oaks. The house was dark, but the exterior was illuminated by a new set of floodlights installed in the flower beds beneath the windows. I followed Paul out to the edge of the driveway and peered down the hill. In the front of the house sat a police cruiser.
I'm sorry, Rocky.
You left me.
I know.
Why did you do that?
I can't say. Don't cry, Rocky.
Devil. I ain't so sure that I really mind.
I want to go home.
I'm gonna have to let you go from here.
I don't want to go alone.
I know.
Paul knelt and grabbed my shoulders and pulled me into him. He held me there, unsteady on his knees, his arms shaking. I could hear his heart rumbling in his chest like the beat of a fast, familiar song. When I think of that moment there on the hill, I imagine Paul standing at the edge of a terrible abyss.
There,
Paul whispered.
Just walk towards the porch lights. I'll watch you all the way.
You ain't no one in this town. To someone, won't you dead? First they lift you up so high.
Where does this leave Rocky? Alone?
Absolutely. He's been terribly betrayed by the person that he idolizes and loves and trusts probably even more than his parents.
The only truth we've ever known lives on the records that were stolen. Yeah, it finds its way to you on the nights you feel alone.
But he's also lost that person in that moment. And I think that the love that he feels for his brother and the desire to have him outweighs the betrayal. And that's where so much of this story comes from. Only love can break your heart, right? Love is stronger than anger, in this character's mind at least, and heart. And so I think that he would be willing to forgive everything to have him back.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to songwriters and musicians, Joey Kneiser and Kelly Smith.
What good does lemon do?
Bonnie Montgomery.
If I were a tobacco farmer, I would smoke while I tilled and drink, bartered beer while I harvest.
Shannon McClung.
You thought it would be a safe thing here.
Ryan Nolan.
Reach down inside, find your inner strength.
The Mallet Brothers.
Sad story you know too well. It's the same sad story.
Gallows Bound.
Tell me how long should I be guilty for things that should last.
Ethan Young. Josiah Simpson. Radio Birds.
Take my eyes, help me see.
Tim Anthony. Travis Bowman. And Amy Jo Savannah.
And I know we'll only let each other.
From music that bespeaks the 70s and speaks to us now.
So let's not, because we'll only let each other right now. We'll only let each other.
Thank you to actors John Mann, Emily McDonough, Jenny Walker, and Gareth Bax for your heartfelt voices. Thanks to the heartbreaking production work of Mr. Chris Hickey, who helps us produce these shows. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to Virginia author Ed Tarkington, whose Buildings Ramon uncovers page by page the fragility of that all too breakable muscle, our heart. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's sit down in our beanbag chairs, turn on our lava lamps, drop a needle on the stereo, and absorb the words of Neil Young. There's two kinds of love. One is right, and one is wrong.